It's Central Time. I'm Rob Fairhead. Last month, Beyoncé became the first black woman to reach number one on Billboard's Hot 100 with a country song, her hit Texas Hold'em. The song also reached number one on Billboard's Hot Country chart.
This ain't Texas. Whoa. Ain't no Hold'em. Hey. So lay your cards down, 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 down. So park your Lexus. Whoa. And throw your keys up.
The song's release has brought back questions about what music gets to be called country. A radio station in Oklahoma initially refused to play it, writing, quote, "We do not play Beyoncé as we're a country music station." In a later statement, that station said they hadn't heard about Beyoncé's country turn. They played the song after they got hundreds of angry messages from her fans. Also in the last few months, Tracy Chapman became the first black woman to win a country music award for songwriting after her 80s song Fast Car was covered by country artist Luke Combs. There's long been a debate over the country music establishment's willingness to embrace black artists, stretching back long before artists like Beyoncé and Lil Nas X. We're talking about black musicians and country music, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Are you a Beyoncé fan? Are you a country fan? Are you both? What are your thoughts on this? Are you excited to hear her forthcoming country album? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Marcus Dowling is the Nashville country music reporter for the Tennessean. That's part of the USA Today network. He was the 2023 Country Music Association Media Achievement Award winner. Marcus, welcome back to Central Time.
It's absolutely a pleasure to be on the air with you.
All right. Your headline here that on your initial piece about this, you co-wrote, Beyoncé's single debuts on country charts, and it's a big deal. Spell out how big a deal it is, Marcus.
Okay, well, fundamentally, you're looking at a genre in country music in the mainstream for the most part, where the industry has been reticent to largely accept the influence of African-American women. There have been black men, obviously, who have had, you know, significant chart-topping success in country music. But as far as, you know, you're dealing with black women, the highlight is 1969 when Color Him Father by Linda Martell reached number 22 on the charts. As well, on top of that, you know, it's taken artists like Mickey Guyton, you know, over a decade to be label signed artists and get, you know, recognition as far as having their albums released to the public. So it's a fundamental flaw in the long standing history of country music, which also as well is the longest standing commercially, you know, available genre in modern American popular music.
Now, a Beyoncé song doing real well with downloads and streams, sure, no surprise there. Is Texas Hold'em being played on country stations?
It's currently at about, you know, 120 to 130 country stations. It's being added slowly. It's currently middling somewhere in the 30s and 40s on the Billboard and media-based airplay charts for country radio. And that's a fascinating thing because that's historically just an unbelievable number right out of the gate. But I feel like there's a larger story yet to be told for Texas Hold'em. One of the things with country radio that people need to understand is that it's usually smaller to middle-sized cities that add these songs first, especially songs that paint outside of the traditional format of country radio. And the larger cities are the ones that typically get on at the end and push something up towards over the top, towards getting towards the top 10 or number one.
It raises a question about country music. Is country music about a musical style, about the way the vocals are performed, about the content of the lyrics, or is it about who's the artist? How do we sort that out?
I'd say that aesthetically, it's a fascinating notion. Country music involves the interplay of the blues and folk and rhythm and blues and soul music and now hip hop and all of these other styles of music that have at their core a traditional root in African American culture. And I think that the fascinating part of that, even deeper, that kind of troubles the water, is that you find that there are typically white artists who are inspired by these sounds to even begin to create music as artists in general. And something is lost in the wash, obviously, by the time these artists become mainstream crossover, ready to, you know, play on country radio artists, where the root of their inspiration is not reflected in the genre in which they create music.
Talking to music reporter Marcus Dowling with the Tennessean, looking at Beyoncé's big country music release. Couple songs, actually, an album to come. How it is and or is it being accepted in the country music establishment? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a country music listener yourself? Do you find your country music on the radio, on the mainstream stations? Do you have to dig deeper? Do you worry about who does and doesn't get to be included in the country music label? Join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Marcus, you got to hang out backstage, I understand, at the Grand Ole Opry with seven black women who perform in country music after this Beyoncé release. What kind of things were they talking about?
Well, I mean, first I'll say I'm always backstage at the Grand Ole Opry. It's part of my job at this point. I treasure that as an honor. But to say that, it's a fascinating point there too, because these are women who are obviously very proud that Beyoncé wants to join in their number in making country music. But they are also women who have incredibly painful, to the point of even saying that they're harrowing, stories of their history in attempting to reach country radio. You have artists like Meeko Marx and Reese Palmer who, in 2007, 2008, attempted to be heard on country radio. And they topped out in the top 50 of country airplay and were told that their songs were too explicitly black and too earnest in their understanding of how they, as black women, understood themselves within the country music marketplace. There's a thought in the country music marketplace, which if you look at, there's a study by Dr. Jada Watson, who's out of Ottawa, Canada, called They Won't Play a Lady-O on Country Radio. It's a song by an artist by the name of Tammy Nielsen. And that study shows that somewhere in the range of, gosh, well over 95% of country radio is dominated by white artists. And to say that these are black women who are hurt by actually being in that 5% is a fascinating thing, even deeper than other fascinating notions I've mentioned in this call. It's the fact that you're proud to be seen, but the stress and strain that you have undergone to be heard is unprecedented. So that's obviously six of one hand and far more than half a dozen in another.
Is there any thought that, okay, when an artist with the clout of Beyoncé breaks in somewhat to country music radio, that might change attitudes among the tastemakers in the country world, that like, okay, maybe we can give these black women we ignored a couple few years ago, maybe we can get them on the playlist next time they come out with something?
There are black women who are signed currently to numerous major labels in Nashville, Tennessee. Universal Music Group has Mickey Guyton. Warner has Madeline Edwards. There are opportunities for everyone. Camille Parker's unsigned currently, but she just topped out at number 80 on the media base charts. So there's a argument that says that. But I think that the bigger, more fascinating thing is that country music, being 100 years old, and never having fundamentally at the top of the genre African-American women as an influential tastemaker and trendsetter in the space is something that, you know, needs to occur, I think. I think that there's a something that could be intriguing and learned by the space overall in allowing for something that's wholly unprecedented but also thoroughly necessary in having African-American women have some measure, even if it's infinitesimally small, of power in the marketplace.
Marcus Dowling is with us, Nashville country music reporter for the Tennessean. We're talking about Beyoncé's country hit and black women country artists, how they have been excluded in many ways from the country music establishment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you wish mainstream country music was more receptive to black artists, to women as well? And what are your thoughts on genre shifting when a musician shifts to country, if that's your genre of choice? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about Beyoncé's number one country hit and black country artists and the reception they get on country music radio, or lack of same. Marcus Dowling is with us, Nashville country music reporter for The Tennessean. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a country music fan? What are your thoughts on Beyoncé putting out a country album? Would you want to see more variety on your local country music station? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls. Jeff is with us in Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good afternoon. Last year, I was thrilled to see The Color Purple come out as a musical. And when I sat in the theater listening to that music, my toes were tapping. Mm-hmm. And this new song by Beyoncé is so catchy. I'm on YouTube watching ordinary Americans do their own dance, their line dances. I mean, you know, when I get to a nursing home, I want to join in.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Marcus, does it matter, given the alternative methods of distribution now, people can be watching and or dancing to this on YouTube or name your platform here, does it matter as much if country music stations are acting as the gatekeepers?
Insofar as looking at country music as a commercial industry, the interplay between radio and marketing and advertising and the fundamental wealth distribution and engagement of country music, radio's the tastemaker and the bellwether there. That's one of the major issues at play here. If you wanted to talk about people accessing Texas Hold'em, it's the number one selling song in country music. Beyoncé's the first African-American woman to ever top that chart. So I think that people are accessing it, but I think that insofar as in all facets of the industry, being able to use it as a space to, you know, be an income generator, that's the main issue. Radio still holds a lot of sway in that conversation.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Wanted to mention another big piece of recent news I mentioned earlier, Marcus. Fast Car, Tracy Chapman hit from the 1980s. She wins a Country Music Award as a songwriter for the cover by Luke Combs. Same lyrics, music not that different, different voice, different face singing it. What do you make of that?
Well, Luke Combs grew up loving Fast Car. Fast Car came out in 1989, so his father had it on a cassette that he played in his truck. So that goes without saying. Like, this plays back to that point of there are numerous white artists in country music who grew up listening to black music. It's a fundamental part of life. If you skip even a little bit further past 89, there's a fascinating piece of data I always like to bring up in these conversations. 1995 to 2005 is the greatest era of physical units sold in the history of domestic popular music. So everybody had access to buying everything. And if you're saying that people didn't buy black music or music made by black people at that time, you're absolutely wrong. So there's a notion that, you know, like white artists, black music is fundamental in their musical DNA. So, of course, when Luke Combs gets an opportunity to sing a cover song, he's going to sing Fast Car. I mean, it's as much of a part of him as Three Chords and the Truth.
Let's bring on another caller. Kristen is with us in Marshfield. Kristen, hi.
Hi there. I just was going to bring up the fact that I think if Dolly Parton can be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and she can produce rock and roll albums, I am totally open and welcome to letting Beyoncé into our country realm. I think she's awesome. But I can tell you, if I go to the Hodeg in Rhinelander and she is a guest there, I want her to play country. I don't want to have her get up there and play one country song and then divert into what everybody knows. And it just wouldn't suit the audience, and it wouldn't be what would be expected for that realm. And
Kristen, I got you. We don't have a lot of time left, but Marcus, that crossover concept, if Beyoncé would fully commit to, you know, playing a whole country set, I believe there's a whole country album coming out.
There's a whole country album coming out, and the fascinating thing about that record is that some of the most vaunted country, folk, Americana, blues, bluegrass players in the world are on that album. So you have people like Rhiannon Giddens, who's a legendary banjo player. She's on Texas Hold'em. That's a clawhammer banjo style playing at the top of that song. And people who understand the banjo as an instrument understand the value of that. Dwayne Dobsey, who's a legendary accordion player, is playing on this record. If you have any questions as to the authenticity of the country music on this record, you're sadly mistaken. This is as country as cornbread, truly.
Kristen, thanks for that call. Marcus, in just our last minute or so, you talked about the artists, the black women who are losing a lot by being left out of the country music establishment. What is country music listening by not losing by not opening those doors?
They're losing the fullness of the American experience. Country music is at a place where it is experiencing unprecedented pop cultural resonance. And to do so without having the fullness of the American experience, that is one that includes African-American women, obviously, then country music is sorely missing unprecedented reach in its growth.
Marcus, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
You're absolutely welcome.
That's Marcus Dowling, Nashville country music reporter for The Tennessean. He talked to us about Beyonce's hit country song and black artists in country music. You can keep sharing your thoughts, by the way. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Northern Wisconsin's snow drought has been dramatic this winter. The region's snowfall has been between 20 and 60 inches below average since November. The lack of snow has been devastating to the state's winter tourism industry, and this winter is on track to become Wisconsin's warmest on record. As Danielle Kading reports, that has forced local businesses and outdoor enthusiasts to adapt.
As the sun shone overhead, blinding white snow blanketed the course at the start of the American Birkebeiner ski race. Temperatures hovered below freezing, and hundreds of skiers and spectators waited for the starting gun at the 50th anniversary of North America's largest cross-country ski race. But if it weren't for artificial snow, it's likely the race would have never happened. Organizers announced in early February that the Berkey would be held on a shorter course and on snow they made themselves.
Pretty amazing that we have no snow otherwise and they were able to still pull off this race.
That's 44-year-old Ann Nischke of Stevens Point. She cheered on elite skiers as they raced laps on a 10-kilometer course and cable. Nischke skied a shorter race the day before. She says even that was tough.
Well, like this year, I didn't train at all.
She switched to running to train for the race, and so did 18-year-old Laura Johnson of Madison. She was waiting to ski a shorter version of the Berkey. While she's glad the event took place, she says it wasn't the same this year.
Because it's not the full thing, and like, I really enjoy going into Hayward and finishing up in the middle of the street.
Some skiers say artificial snow made the course icy and difficult to navigate. Others say it created faster conditions and praised organizers for pulling off the race. But 64-year-old Rich Montana of Amory was just glad the event happened at all.
Thank God there's man-made snow.
About a 20-minute drive away in downtown Hayward, people are shopping at businesses like Riverbrook Bike and Ski.
Thank you.
Cindy Smith-Kaner co-owns the shop. She says the lack of snow means ski sales have been almost non-existent, and many businesses are saying revenues are down 75%.
We're just looking ahead. I don't want to dwell on that number. Just think to the future, and I think it makes you be more conservative and diversified.
Hotels, lodges, and restaurants have missed out on customers who usually come up to ski, snowmobile, and ice fish. That's according to Chris Ruckdashel with the Hayward Area Chamber of Commerce. He says some businesses have reported losses of hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's prompted the chamber to promote the use of ATVs instead.
It's helped a lot. It just hasn't completely replaced what otherwise would have been.
Not all businesses say the warm winter is hurting their bottom line.
And then she's going to do a glass of Prosecco.
K Caroline Gertis with Three Fly Sisters Taps and Wines says some people have been more willing to get out of their homes with the warmer weather.
You know, despite the no snow, we've been extremely busy. I think because we're not dependent on that snowmobile traffic and we're right in town, everyone's shopping and doing fun things.
At Myers Beach on Lake Superior, ice melts in the midday sun along the shoreline before giving way to open water. A decade ago, almost 150,000 people visited here to see the ice caves within the Apostle Islands National Lakeshore. The ice caves haven't been open to the public since 2015. This year, Neil Schrader of Washburn saw the massive ice formations from a kayak.
Big chunks of ice, goes some 30 feet long, and then little tiny icicles inside the caves and on things, and from the water splashing up against it. It was just a real beautiful, surreal kind of experience.
Schrader has paddled to the caves a couple times this winter, but he warned it's dangerous. An emergency room physician, he says people could die within seconds if they fall in the icy waters. While he enjoys winter paddling, he says the warmer weather has been kind of a bummer.
But, you know, you have to kind of adapt. Go running, go kayaking, do other things.
Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read more about that story and see all the latest stories from our news team over at WPR.org. Also, join WPR Thursday night at 8 for live coverage of the 2024 State of the Union Address. President Joe Biden will deliver the address to a joint meeting of Congress. NPR has live special coverage of that and the Republican Party's response. NPR's Steve Inskeep hosts, members of the NPR Politics team, will join the coverage in the studio and from the U.S. Capitol. That special coverage of the 2024 State of the Union, Thursday at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Since 2019, the Winnebago Mental Health Institute in Oshkosh has seen a 30% increase in involuntary detentions. Winnebago is the only state-run psychiatric hospital in Wisconsin, except for Mendota Mental Health Institute, which is intended for people in the criminal justice system. A lack of psychiatric beds in cities and towns around the state means that many people end up at Winnebago, a journey that can include hours handcuffed in the back of a patrol car for people in the midst of a mental health emergency. A new bill aims to improve crisis care by establishing emergency mental health care centers around the state. One of the sponsors of that bill joins us now. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions. Do you work in the mental health care field? What are your thoughts on Wisconsin's mental health care system, especially when it comes to crisis care? Have you or a family member needed to look for emergency mental health care? Was it there for you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Clint Moses is a Republican representing the 29th District of the Wisconsin Assembly that includes parts of St. Croix County and Dunn County. He's a sponsor of the bill that would establish regional mental health crisis care facilities in the state. Representative Moses, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good to be here.
Can you run us through the basics of what this legislation would do if passed?
Yeah, I was super excited to actually get this one across the finish line. It cleared the Assembly on a unanimous vote, 97-0, also passed the Senate, and it's actually sitting, I'll be on the governor's desk shortly to hopefully get signed into law. But basically, and you already kind of covered it in the intro a little bit, but these regional facilities are designed to offer the same resources and care as Winnebago Mental Health Institute, but just closer to home and closer to the patient support system. These facilities treat the individual's mental health or substance abuse disorder And it saves law enforcement, especially in outstate like where I'm from. I actually represent Dunn St. Croix in just a little corner of Polk County up in northwest Wisconsin. And it's, you know, a 10-hour round trip for law enforcement to transport these people down there. So not only is it detrimental to the patient that's suffering the a crisis, essentially, but it's also a huge burden on law enforcement and the taxpayer because it costs just a lot of time where they're out of our communities. So I was proud to author this bill. Obviously, my position is chair of the Health Committee, Health, Aging, Long-Term Care Committee. I work very closely with DHS, and we've been working on this for quite a while.
So how would these new centers be spread out around the state?
Well, in the bill, it specifies that the first one has to be 100 miles or more away from Winnebago Health Institute, and then in the western part of the state. So that could be northwest Wisconsin. It could be southwest. The Senate author lead on this, Howard Markline, obviously coming from the southwest part of the state, would like to see it there. I would love to see something up in Eau Claire or St. Croix County, like maybe New Richmond or even Hudson for that matter.
Going back to police resources, I understand, you know, there's some communities that the police department, you know, may number in the single digits. So having maybe two police officers out of town is actually a serious impairment to their ability to do their daily jobs. Is that something you're hearing in your district?
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, personally, that's where I kind of came in on this. I mean, I've had predecessors, legislators over the last 8 to 10 years that have said this is a problem. We need to get something done here. Obviously, this money was actually put in the last biennium's budget, $10 million initially, and DHS did not essentially have a blueprint on how to use it. So this bill spells that out. It is a big burden on our law enforcement, especially those smaller communities that do not have a lot of resources.
Can you talk about what it'll take to get these regional facilities up and running? And we know there are problems with having access to staff, to being able to hire people, a lot of different kinds of health and mental health care facilities around the state. What is that hurdle once this is passed and in place?
Yeah, well, I think one of the things, actually, if you've been following along in the Chippewa Valley with the HS closure, we do have some of the staffing that might be available from that situation where they could certainly work in these facilities. Obviously, healthcare providers of any kind, and I shouldn't say just healthcare providers, just finding staffing is a challenge. That's probably the biggest hurdle, but I do think there's plenty of staff out there to at least fill the initial void or need for this. My hope is that we start out with one or two, and this proves to be so successful that it's something we add to the budget and we expand on so that eventually maybe we have at least five of these regional mental health facilities, one per DHS district. The DHS has five districts throughout the state. It'd be nice to at least see one in each district.
Talking to State Assembly Representative Clint Moses about legislation he co-sponsored on its way to being signed into law that would establish regional mental health crisis facilities around the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Samantha is with us in northwest Wisconsin. Samantha, hi.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call. I was going through a very hard time in my life, and depression was at an all-time high. Anxiety was at an all-time high. And someone called the police because they were concerned for my mental health. I had no of harming myself. However, the police handcuffed me, took me to the local police department where I was interrogated, and then taken to another community where I was given a physical examination. I had my bra and underwear on and were handcuffed and put in the back of the police car with really giving no reason that I could understand at the time, and driven to Winnebago, arriving in the middle of the night. I was 58 years old then, to go through a horrifying intake experience to get a cell with a person I had no clue what was going on. And I kept crying all the time, and I was crying, and they wouldn't let me out. I was crying because I was terrified. I was in there with people who made the news, people who were in there because they needed considerable help. And it was a horrific experience. I still have nightmares about it. and I would do whatever I could to support mental health facilities being scattered across the state. No one should have to go through this nightmare ever that I experienced, all involuntarily. No one listened to me. They didn't care.
I'm so sorry to hear that, Samantha. Horrifying experience, and I thank you for sharing your story with us. Representative Moses, obviously there are a lot of questions to talk about when it comes to when somebody can be involuntarily detained in that way, but part of Samantha's story was being taken to Winnebago. She would very much have liked to have a local option. At least that part of the story you're hoping your legislation could help with.
Yeah, for sure. And this includes involuntary and voluntary adults. And then it is optional for them to take youth as well that might be suffering one of these incidents. But Samantha's story is all too common. I mean, I had constituents reaching out, and then honestly, people across the state with similar stories. And it just, I can only imagine what it's like. So I feel for, and this is exactly the purpose of the bill.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Can you talk, to get to some nuts and bolts here, can you talk about funding for these regional centers? How are they funded, and how would funding work if they are expanded in the future?
Yeah, in the initial, like I said, there was $10 million that was set aside last budget for this. Some of that money does come from the opiate money that the state received as well. And my hope is, you know, because $10 million, that seems like a lot. But when you start talking about hiring security and mental health professionals and the facility itself, that will be taken up pretty quick. So like I said earlier, my hope is that this proves to be so successful that it's something we want to fund. And I mean, even as a conservative or a Republican, you know, just the finances of it really add up. Besides the humanitarian part of it, doing the right thing for patients and people across the state, it financially makes sense too, because right now this puts too much burden on our local government and our local law enforcement.
And Representative Moses, before I let you go, we often think of Democrat versus Republican in our state and national governments. Can you talk about this as an example of, as you mentioned, I believe a unanimous vote in the assembly, a place where party doesn't matter as much?
Yeah, and this is one, I mean, it's just something that we all agree on, and this is what makes it fun to go down to Madison and get stuff done, because it isn't the partisan bickering that we see so much on the news, especially at the federal level and even at the state level. This thing received support from absolutely every assembly representative that was in the room on the floor 2 weeks ago and voted for it. So I'm excited for that. Obviously, as chair of the health committee, I am super excited to see this come across the finish line.
Representative Moses, thanks again for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That's Clint Moses, Republican representing the 29th District in the Wisconsin Assembly in the northwestern part of the state. We're talking about a bill that he introduced that would establish regional mental health crisis care facilities in Wisconsin. We'll talk to a mental health advocate coming up in just a few, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or maybe an experience to share? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up that conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about emergency psychiatric care in Wisconsin and proposed policies aimed at improving it. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one required emergency mental health care in Wisconsin? What was that experience like? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share that, that's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sita Deal is the Public Policy and Advocacy Director for NAMI Wisconsin. That's the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Sita, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about the role of crisis care when it comes to mental health care in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the crisis care is, you know, like emergency care. If we take care of our mental health early, and if we identify mental illness and mental health problems early and get effective help, there will be fewer psychiatric crises. So there's one key to bending the health curve toward well-being, and that is school-based mental health services. And we have pretty good school-based mental health services in Wisconsin. We need more. Because if kids can get help early in school where they spend their time, we'll get much better outcomes. So we're making progress, but we need more state funding and we need private insurance to lean in.
And for the crisis system in general, I've been hearing for years about this concern that people in so much of the state, the only recourse is Winnebago and Oshkosh, hours by police car. Do you see this legislation, I was just talking to Representative Moses, at least helping with that one piece of the puzzle?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And I want to start by thanking Representative Moses and Senator Howard Markline for authoring this bill. As they said, it's been a long time coming, and they did a beautiful job of setting the framework to establish these centers. So, and it's, as they said, it's been refreshingly bipartisan and a lot of collaboration between the legislature and the administration. So kudos to everybody who's been involved.
Sita, I want to look at next steps after somebody who's been through this situation, received emergency psychiatric care voluntarily or involuntarily. Do we have enough follow-up then to stay with them and make sure they don't end up back there in weeks or months?
Yeah, well, so Wisconsin is building on the National Crisis Now model, which entails having somebody to call, someone to come, and a safe place to go for anybody who's in crisis anywhere, anytime. So we're ahead of the curve in some ways because Wisconsin law already requires counties to provide 24/7 call service and on-site response, which in the smaller counties, as Rep. Moses was saying, is often law enforcement. But the counties, we already have small crisis stabilization facilities if people want to go. So it's only for voluntary care. And these are home-like centers where somebody can receive counseling, they're in a safe place, but we don't have enough of them, and we certainly don't have enough of them for youth. We only have two for youth, and they can't be a place where law enforcement officers can drop people off if they need treatment but don't want treatment. So it was like Samantha was talking about. So what these crisis urgent care centers will do is they will deliver prompt, compassionate psychiatric care in that precious moment of crisis. So if you think about it, you know, a crisis is an opportunity for growth, and people who are in a crisis, all of their old patterns are kind of, everything's thrown up into the air. And if you can get good help right in that first 23 hours, if you can get compassionate help, then most crises can be resolved. And then fewer people will have to go to psychiatric hospital anywhere in the state, much less Oshkosh. And you noted that the trend has been going up since 2013. That's abnormal. We don't need that. If we can get people the care they need in that 23 hours of crisis, then we'll have a lot lower need for hospitalization.
Sita Deal is with us from NAMI, Wisconsin, looking at emergency mental health care in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Gwen is with us in Madison. Gwen, what did you want to tell us about?
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I worked with inpatient psychiatric as a registered nurse for over a decade here in Wisconsin. And I do want to say that I applaud highly any effort that are being made to provide more access to this type of care for patients. It's very important. However, I do want to add one thing that I hadn't heard, and that is the issue of medical clearance. When someone seems to be in acute psychiatric distress, we need to make sure that there's not a drug or an illness that is causing this. I've had patients come in who they thought was having a schizophrenic break and she had meningitis. I've had patients come in who had overdosed. Those issues really need to be addressed before they get...
Gotcha. Gwen, an interesting point. Sita, how important is that?
Yeah, very, very important. And that's the reason, the exact reason why we need these crisis urgent care centers, because they will be staffed 24/7 with prescribers and with psychiatric counselors and with nurses, much more highly staffed than the crisis stabilization facilities. So it's basically a psychiatric emergency room, and they will have the capacity and the routine to assess medical or substance use and mental health crises and sort one from another. And she's absolutely right. Often a psychiatric condition will mask or it'll start to look like a general medical condition or vice versa. And so, you know, like I have a relative who had what looked like a psychiatric crisis and he was actually in renal failure. And so they really had to get him to the hospital. So this is what these centers will sort out. But one of the good things about these centers is that the transportation, if somebody needs to go to another facility for follow-on care, whether it's substance use care or general medical care or mental health care, they will go in the facility's vehicle. The bill specifies that, not in the back of a law enforcement vehicle, handcuffed in the back of a squad car. So that's a much more, I've been thinking about the earlier caller, it's a much more dignified process. But the crisis urgent care centers will have capacity and will have the part of their job is to sort out medical substance use and mental health crises.
Thanks again for that call, Gwen. Sita, you mentioned earlier early interventions through schools and things like that to help hopefully prevent these things coming to a crisis situation in the first place. Also wanted to ask about access to mental health care in Wisconsin. We heard from a caller who couldn't stay at Ellen in Cedarburg who went through a similar crisis. Since then, she said it took her a year to get a therapist for people who need some kind of personalized mental health care. Do we have it? Do we have enough of it in Wisconsin?
Right now, the answer is no. But the pandemic was a boom in many ways in that people can now get telehealth, and the data show that counseling through telehealth is as satisfying for the person and as effective for the person and also as satisfying for the clinician as in-person care. So that means that we can stretch the existing capacity of our existing workforce, but we also need absolutely more bodies. We need more experts in care. And so we've got something called the Qualified Treatment Trainee Program, where people who are emerging from their social work or their licensed professional counseling or the marriage and family counseling, marriage and family therapist programs can get supervision, the required 3,000 hours of supervision paid for by the state. And right now that's on COVID relief money, a little bit of general purpose revenue from the state, but we need more general purpose revenue to keep that program going at the elevated level because we have a dire workforce shortage in Wisconsin. We also need to use all kinds of providers. So we have a strong peer support program in Wisconsin, but we're not utilizing it well. And there's the pipeline between finding people who have recovered to the point where they're turning again to help someone else and they want to become a certified peer specialist, getting them trained and then getting them placed and then, you know, having the support that they need in order to do good work. That pipeline needs to be straightened out. We're not finding everybody that we need in order to fulfill that level of care. But those people can spend a lot of time walking with somebody. You can see your psychiatrist maybe once every 3 months or once every 6 months. You can see your counselor, you know, maybe once a month. And as the caller said, it takes a long time to get into care, but a peer support specialist can help walk with the person and help give them hope and help them find the support they need in the interim while these professional services are in the wings.
Sita, just briefly, this peer support idea keeps coming up when we have conversations about mental health care. Are we working toward that? Are you seeing people make that system work better to get people connected with peers just in our last half a minute or so?
Yeah, absolutely. We have 5 or 6 peer respite centers around the state, which are basically step down or step up facilities. Like you're going into a crisis, you need to chill, you need somebody to talk to who has been there, or you're coming out of hospital and you're just not quite ready to go home. So you can sit and somebody will listen to you who understands what you're going through. And then we have peer recovery centers throughout the state, which is a place to go because isolation is a killer. When you're talking to mental illness about mental illness, literally a killer. And so if you can have a place to go where you're accepted, we have both peer recovery centers and clubhouses, which are basically community centers for people with mental illness.
Sita, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's Sita Deal, Public Policy and Advocacy Director for NAMI Wisconsin. She talked to us about the state of emergency psychiatric care in the state, Earlier, we heard from Assembly Representative Clint Moses about a new bill aimed at providing more access to emergency mental health care in more parts of the state, expected to be signed into law possibly as soon as today. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, get a firsthand look at life in Antarctica with a Wisconsin researcher who spent time on the planet's least habitable continent. Join in with your questions and listen along tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. If you're a fan of spicy peppers, you might have noticed something about jalapenos, that they seem to be less hot. The thing is, you might be right. As reported in D Magazine, that's D as in Dallas, Texas, apparently it's a pretty common complaint for home and restaurant cooks that jalapenos don't seem to be as hot and spicy as they used to. After some reporting, it seems like that may be true, and it happened on purpose. Why? Here's the story they tell. Companies that package salsas and other foods want their products to be predictable, and jalapenos weren't. There was a lot of variety. So people started breeding strains of jalapenos to provide more consistent, predictable levels of heat, and they aimed for less heat because it's easier to start with a mellow jalapeno and add more spice to it in your salsa or whatever than it is to start with a spicy jalapeno and try to take the heat out. One possible solution, grow your own using heirloom seeds. Me, I used to eat spicier food. Nowadays, I keep my salsa safely in the mild zone. Too hot for radio. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. If you're online or using an app, chances are there's an algorithm recommending what you read, watch, or listen to next. With the rise of social media and platforms like YouTube, Netflix, and Spotify, algorithms have come to shape our experience online in a profound way, and our next guest says it's shaping our lives offline, too. You could join in at 800-642-1234. When you're on social media or a streaming service, do you find that you're getting good stuff recommended to you, stuff that you want to see? Or is it just more and more of the same thing you liked already? Do you keep watching that sort of stuff? Do you wish you could break out of that somehow? Join in at 800-642-1234. And if you find cool stuff in other ways, from friends or a critic or something, where do you go for those independent suggestions of what to watch or read? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kyle Chayka is a staff writer for The New Yorker covering technology and culture on the internet. His new book is called Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start big picture before we start prying open these algorithms. What is it like living in filter world? What do you mean by that concept?
Yeah, I mean, as you introduced in the show, we're now surrounded by all of these algorithmic recommendations. And these are digital platforms that are pushing content at us, constantly telling us what we should be watching or what we might be interested in. The next song on Spotify, the next video on TikTok, a show to watch on Netflix. And I just wanted to come up with a word to describe how we're being bombarded by these recommendations all the time.
And with algorithms, whether they're used in culture, which is what you're focusing on, or whatever, there's a sense, I think, well, it's like math and science, so we're getting the right answer to this. A big key point of your book is they were created in every instance with a human intention, with an outcome that the creators are hoping for. Lift the veil behind the algorithms that shape our cultural lives.
Absolutely. I think we often forget that the algorithms we interact with online are decisions made by tech companies. So it's not just an equation that perfectly measures your interests and your tastes and gives you what you're going to be interested in. But instead, it's this equation that helps the tech company make more profit. So in the case of Spotify, it's that you keep listening to songs. On Facebook, it's that you're engaging with the articles that are in your feed and you're constantly looking for more. So I think it really helps to keep in mind what incentives we're looking at here.
And you have this idea of algorithms flattening our culture. What do you mean by flattening?
I think there's this overall homogenization going on. And I think it's happening because all of these equations are essentially programmed to give us more of what we're already interested in. So Spotify will give you more songs that are kind of like the songs you already like. X or Twitter will give you more tweets that kind of follow what you've shown that you're interested in. And I think over time, it's kind of like a funnel where all the users on a platform are being funneled into these buckets of content that follow certain themes that they've expressed interest in. And I think it's hard to break out of this system. It's hard to say to the algorithm, I don't want more of the same thing. Like, I want to get some different perspectives or get a different kind of content.
Now, of course, when you say algorithm and all this, I think of online stuff. But one of your starting points, actually, in an article you wrote years ago, was in the real world. And it was that cool local coffee shop looks the same as that cool local coffee shop in another state, another country, another continent. Could you talk us through how that flattened out, in part based on algorithms?
Right. I mean, I noticed this phenomenon, I think, starting around 2015, 2016, that all these quote unquote local coffee shops, wherever I went, tended to look the same. And this was, you know, no matter if I'm in the United States or in China or Germany or anywhere else, the coffee shop had this look that was like white subway tiles on the walls, lumpy ceramic mugs with, you know, latte art in them, brightly colored blobby posters on the walls. And I think that generic quality, it wasn't because a parent company was telling coffee shop owners to decorate their places the same way, like a Starbucks. It was because suddenly in the 2010s, we all got sucked into these massive digital platforms and we all started following each other and chasing the same trends and looking at the same aesthetics. And that creates an overall flattening over time because we're all just kind of following the same ideas and following the same algorithmic currents. So our tastes harmonize, as one person told me.
Kyle Chayka is with us. We're talking about his new book. It's called Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kyle, most of us are using social media platforms, things like that, as consumers, but you also look at how this affects creators. And if there's an algorithm that says, hey, this is the kind of thing I'm going to put in front of people, creators, if they want their stuff to be seen, are kind of chasing the algorithm, which is easier said than done. What did you find when you looked into that?
It's so true. I mean, I think as consumers, so much of our attention is mediated by these feeds. Like, we're watching and listening to what the algorithms recommend to us. And so if you're an artist, like a musician or a painter or, you know, a choreographer, you have to think about what is going to work on these platforms. So you have to think about what looks good on Instagram, what kind of dance moves are going to play well on TikTok, what kind of music is going to be picked up as a viral TikTok sound. And those are kind of the commercial demands of our time, I think. I mean, even as an author, publishers would ask me, how many followers do you have on Twitter? You know, how many people are already in your audience online? So I think our presences online as creators and the trends going on these platforms really shape how we make our art.
And not just art, but also media. I think we're going to have a training in the works on the dreaded SEO, search engine optimization, here at Wisconsin Public Radio. You talked about at one point in your life somehow, and I didn't quite get how this worked, working what looked like wedding announcements into some of your work to try to get picked up and get SEO optimized. This also shapes how we try to deliver news to people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that particular anecdote was from Facebook in like the early 2010s. And people had figured out that if you pretended to announce a wedding or an engagement, you would get boosted by the algorithm, because obviously the algorithm registers this wedding or engagement idea and is like, okay, tons of people are going to want to see this. And so, and rather than actually announcing a wedding, you would be like, here's my wedding announcement, yay, congratulate me, but here's actually my new news story that I just wrote. And so it would be a hack in a way. You were trying to hack the algorithm, but it was so hard to tell what would actually work and what wouldn't. I think over time we all develop these superstitions about algorithmic recommendations.
And that points to a big point in your book is, and other people noted this, a lack of transparency in algorithms, whether they stay the same for years or Facebook makes a big change or whatever. We, the consumers at least, don't know what is driving what's being shown to us. How big a problem do you see that?
Oh, it's such a big problem. I mean, there's so much opacity. I mean, people literally describe algorithms as black boxes. We're interacting with these digital platforms, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, or even a news app like Apple News, and we literally can't tell how they're working. We can't tell how they're recommending us stories or pieces of content, and we can't tell when they change, and they change a lot. These algorithmic recommendations and the equations that drive them are always changing. The variables are always a little different. And when they do change, we sense that there's this huge difference in the system without necessarily being told. Like in recent years, Instagram really changed from promoting still images, like photos, to promoting videos. And no one said that out loud. But if suddenly if you posted a video, you would get tons of promotion. And obviously, you want, if you want to get that attention, if you want to promote your work or your life update, you're going to post that video. So it really shapes and dictates almost what you're putting out there.
It's a black box to us as consumers. But as we started off, it's not such a black box to the people creating it. They know what their goal is and what they're trying to nudge us toward. More and more, that seems to stuff that's going to serve their advertisers.
Absolutely. So, I mean, how most digital platforms work is that they sell advertising. So you are not paying Facebook money. Instead, Facebook is surveilling what you look at, what stories you click on, what you buy, and then selling that data to advertisers who want to get your attention as well. So I think it also helps to remember the sole purpose, like the ultimate goal of all of these systems, is to sell more advertising. It's not to give you a better experience or deliver the thing that you're going to be most inspired by. It's literally to just track you better and sell you more ads.
Kyle Chayka is with us, staff writer at The New Yorker, covering technology and culture on the internet. We're talking about his new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flatten Culture. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share your streaming, TV streaming experience or music streaming, say, or YouTube watching or whatever, is there a platform that you think gives you the content that you want pretty reliably, or do you find it unsatisfying? Does it seem to be to you like it's trying to get more money out of you over time? Or if you have ways of finding cool stuff, whether it's music or TV or movies, whatever, where do you go for it? Who is your source if it's not an online algorithm? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kyle Chayka, author of the new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever taken time off of technology to avoid algorithms? Do you think platforms like Facebook or search engines like Google are doing a good job of connecting you with content you wanted to find and that you enjoy? Or do you think the recommendations are getting worse? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller now. Nick is with us in Beloit. Nick, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
I'm doing all right. I find that like a lot of things I like are on specific channels or the people in the stores themselves. So like, book reviews, I find, I always talk to this one guy at Barnes Noble who works there. He always just knows everything. But if I have a channel online, I want to say the KEXP channel on YouTube or like the NPR Tiny Desk Concerts, they'll seem to just pick the right things.
Interesting, Nick. Thanks a lot. And Kyle, Nick is finding things that a person at the store or the record store or something like NPR's Tiny Desk Concert. You write about this in the book, where to look for inspiration and new stuff that isn't driven by an algorithm.
Yeah, I love this because it just speaks to how the original recommendation engine was another person, ideally an expert in whatever you're looking for. So it's great to go to the bookstore and ask a clerk at the store for a recommendation because they're going to know, you know, what the new books are, what you might be interested in. And that's a more human relationship and interaction than going on the Amazon homepage. Or connecting with a really cool cultural institution like KEXP, which is a radio station that produces really cool concert videos and puts them on YouTube. So I think, I mean, it's a good point also that you don't have to get offline to avoid algorithms. Like you can seek out really cool human curators, as I call them in the book, and people with really great taste and just consume what they post online as well.
Thanks a lot for that call, Nick, at 800-642-1234. That trip to the bookstore, Kyle, reminds me, you took kind of a surreal bookstore visit at an Amazon brick-and-mortar bookstore. Describe that for me. I've never been to one of these. It sounds weird.
It was very weird, and I have to preface this with, I think Amazon has now closed all of their bookstores because they were so unpleasant. But it was, you walked into the bookstore and all of the books, for one thing, were facing outwards. So you could just see thousands of covers everywhere, which was very chaotic. And the books were all organized by their kind of data on the Amazon website. So the books were sorted by what ratings they got, how many people read them, you know, whether they got a lot of good comments on the review section. And it just struck me as so strange because this was essentially bringing the digital experience into reality. And it just underlined how unpleasant that is. Like, I don't care when I'm in a bookstore, I don't care how many other people have bought a book. I don't care what the star rating is. What I'm really engaged with is what's in that book. Like, or do the people in the store like it? Like I personally look for those staff recommendation, you know, little pieces of paper underneath the books. Yeah, it just showed that the variables we measure on the internet for culture really don't stand up in the real world. And if we see them, you know, outside the physical world, it actually seems quite bizarre.
Talking to Kyle Chayka about his new book, Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. Kyle, I could see there being an argument like, okay, yeah, now it's algorithms. Back in the day, it was advertisers and marketing departments and network officials kind of figuring out a lowest common denominator where we could bring people in and flattening culture in a different way. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
I think so. I mean, it's hard to say that one era is better or worse than another. I think in this era, algorithms have really taken over that role. And I think, you know, there are good and bad qualities to those kind of human gatekeepers too. So on the bad side, like the record label executive or the museum curator or the bookstore buyer, like they tend to ignore a lot of people. They might have their own blind spots in terms of like race or class, certainly. So there's flaws there for sure. But also what they are uniquely capable of doing is introducing a new voice into culture and just kind of picking something out based on their own taste and saying this thing is something that more people should see. And I think that had a way of highlighting more unusual or radical or interesting pieces of culture than what we're facing right now, which is essentially the tyranny of data. Like what we end up seeing the most is what is the most already popular, like that Amazon store. Like the metric is always what the most other people have clicked on is what you are going to be most likely to see or hear or watch.
Now, another element of the flattening of culture I'm reading in your book, Kyle, is the idea of good enough. So like the algorithm recommends something that's kind of like something else I liked, whether it's Netflix or YouTube or whatever. And that's fine. I'll go with that. I may not get that radically cool new thing, but I won't get that radically awful bad thing that doesn't fit with what I like. So we just kind of settle into this. And it isn't always fun. When I realize I'm there, I don't like it that much. You either.
I think there's an averageness to that. I talk about the quality of being ambient in the book a lot. And this is a word that the musician Brian Eno came up with in the 70s. And it referred to stuff that was as ignorable as it is interesting. So you could easily ignore it and just like not really pay attention to it. And it would be pleasant enough. You could have it in the background. But then again, it wouldn't necessarily be so interesting. It wouldn't move you. It might not upset you. So I think we're kind of settling for that average quality. And what we're missing out on is the stuff that you might hate. Like it avoids you being too alienated or turned off by a piece of culture, but it's also lessening that kind of extremely moving, unique experience you have when you encounter a work of art that seems like just made for you and something that's just feels personal.
You did a personal experiment, Kyle. You tried to take some time and break free of algorithms. Talk about that experiment and what you learned.
This was an algorithm cleanse that I did, I think, in late 2022. And this was as I was finishing up writing the book. And I just felt totally overwhelmed by the internet. I'd been thinking about it so deeply for this book. And so basically, I cut myself off from all of these digital platforms that were driven by algorithms. I was not on social media. I wasn't listening to Spotify. I wasn't watching Netflix. And it really forced me to reset my relationship with the internet, because so much of the internet is driven by algorithms. And it made me think a lot more about what I was consuming and be more intentional about what I was consuming. So I think overall it was a really healthy move, but the first few weeks were absolutely painful.
You're speaking in the past tense. I assume you've come back to that sort of thing, but do you find, having done that, that you're more intentional about what you consume as opposed to, yeah, let her rip, see what plays next?
I think so. I mean, it did offer that kind of like reset. So I separated myself from the internet a little bit. I think I realized that my identity depended less on it and I didn't need it to inform quite so many of my decisions. So I was able to step back, and now I do think I'm a little more intentional, a little more aware of what I'm consuming, and just more aware of how things get to me. Like, when you don't have an algorithm delivering you stuff, when you don't have recommendations pushing stuff at you, you have to work harder yourself. You have to seek things out and kind of figure out what you're interested in.
One thing I've loved lately, Kyle, is I have a couple friends who are cooler than me, which is easy to do, who do things on Twitch or Mixcloud with audiences, you know, hovering around 10 people or so, where they share a bunch of music. Mm. Some of it I love, some of it I hate. I discover a lot of great new stuff. Do you think we need to do more of that, just sharing with friends in person, online, and curating for each other a little bit?
For sure. I would love more people to curate for each other. I think there's this misconception that like taste or being a curator is somehow a super elite activity that's only for insiders or, you know, tastemakers. But really anyone can do it. It's just about sharing what you like and sharing what makes you inspired or interested. So I love that example of just being on Twitch for 10 people. Like, on the internet, we're so often tempted to try for as big audience as possible, to try to like go viral or get more likes or whatever. And you really don't need to do that. Like, in the rest of history and in our normal lives, reaching 10 people was great. That's like a much more sustainable human interaction than going viral on TikTok or something.
That's a good place to leave it. Kyle, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, this was lovely. Thank you.
That's Kyle Chayka, staff writer at The New Yorker. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Filter World, How Algorithms Flattened Culture. You can still share your thoughts on where you go to discover cool new movies, music, TV shows, whatever. Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Biden administration is boosting its calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, but negotiations haven't gotten there yet. We'll get the latest on the conflict and the humanitarian disaster going on in the region. And we'll get some reactions to the Super Tuesday primaries and the road ahead for the presidential race. You can join in and share your reactions, and we'll hear from longtime Wisconsin conservative voice Charlie Sykes. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.